I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s,
she looked like a million bucks,
scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hi, Shereen.
Ah, oh,
that's okay.
That's what you get for doing Zoom podcast, family. This is another episode of Ethnically Ambiguous. I had a great time today. Yes. We were joined by the lovely Carl Tart. We talk about his upbringing in Mississippi and then in LA, yes. How he got into improv.
Yes.
Stay tuned to the very end. We talk in Farsi and Arabic. We have a great fucking time.
Stay tuned.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Anna!
Hi, Shereen.
Hi, how are you?
You know, very serious person. I'm a businesswoman these days. Capitalism, what are the keywords? Oppression systems.
Yeah, that's how we're going to start off this one. We're going to start off with oppression and capitalism, just some light topics. Today, we are recording with someone that I feel like has always been in our periphery, at least for me, mm-hmm. and I've always wanted to have him on the podcast. We've both wanted him on the podcast, but now it's finally happening. The time has come. We're joined by the lovely Carl Tart.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for calling me lovely. I needed that today.
Oh,
the loveliest.
Yay. You are lovely.
I'm having a bad hair day.
Well, you're wearing a hat. I can't tell.
Yeah, that's why I'm wearing a hat.
Good point.
In my house.
I always have a bad hair day. My hair's not made to look not bad. It's just like curls that go everywhere and like frizz. I've just given up on trying.
I mean, my hair is falling out at a rapid rate ever since like February. So I feel like my body has like used my hair as like the way it's telling me it's falling apart and like aging and like it's not doing okay with stress. It's just like, you're going to lose all your hair now. So I don't think this is a good time for hair. This is not the year for hair. It's not the year for hair.
It's not the year for hair.
No.
That's the one thing we'll remember about 2020. It's like, man, our hair was not great.
Yeah, out of everything that's happened, we'll just remember, my hair didn't look that great.
What a time to be alive.
Yeah.
Well, Carl, if you guys don't know who Carl is, maybe you know him from many appearances on Comedy Bang Bang. You might know him from formerly of Against the Grain and then formerly of Culture Kings and... Mm-hmm. Currently a Flagrant Ones, which is a Patreon podcast.
Yeah, spin that bread.
Yeah, so I might do it because I just like, I like you and I like your co-hosts, but I like the NBA, but I can't listen if it's too, if it's too much about the stats and stuff, because then I really like zone out. But if it's more about like the players, because I am all about like my one of my secret fetishes is NBA player Instagrams. I have like a rating of like best to worst of like who knows how to use it and who doesn't.
Oh, wow. I didn't know this.
And how, it's all I think about. I'll just be like looking at the Instagrams like, are you fucking kidding me, James Harden? Like, we get it. You know how to like shoot. Like, I need to see your family. Get like Russell Westbrook posting his twins. You know, like, I need some. Anyway, if I really
but at the same time
about this. I don't
really like stalk their Instagrams that much, but on the occasion that I do look it up, like the one time I was on LeBron's Instagram, for example, watched his stories and he was like working out on a yacht, and I was like,
oh, I remember
cool.
this time.
You want to see that? That's stuff that you want to see. I want to see him working out on a yacht just as much as I want to see Lil Zuri do a TikTok dance.
Yeah,
like I want to see both of those.
Her career,
but
is
I will
popping.
Say I agree with Anna about being more invested in the players because like
I just like who they are.
Yeah, like I will watch a game because Kawhi Leonard is playing. I won't watch a game because it's just a game. I need to be invested in like the characters and the story, and that's how I really get into sports. It's not actually sports; it's just the players, which is not really basketball. It's just liking a certain player more than others.
Yeah, you know, our podcast is definitely a lot of talk not about stats because I don't know. Stats.
Yeah.
I don't know that stuff. It's so funny. Like, stat nerds trip me out because, like, I played basketball for a long time and at a high level. And I don't understand, like, what PER is. I don't understand that stuff. I don't get it. I know how to put the ball in the basket and play defense, stop other people from putting the ball in the basket.
Yeah.
Like, I don't get all that stuff. So, our show is very much more comedy based than it is stats and stuff
That's
like
good.
That.
Yeah. That's good to
people
hear.
People get mad. One thing about it though, when we say every time, like, this show is our opinion on what we think, and the fans just, you know, they hate your opinions if they're not exactly like theirs.
Yeah. Well, especially with sports, people get really invested and like and kind of crazy about their fan, like their fandom. Fandom is a really real thing, especially with sports. I think that the world of sports is like the one world where you can really see someone get really obsessed about something that doesn't really affect them, but
at
it's
all.
Okay. But like it's, you know, like I've always kind of been really fascinated by that phenomenon of like getting so invested in something that has no effect on your life. I've seen tattoos, like people get, you know what I mean? It's just like, that's a wild thing to me, but that's the power of sports.
That's part of a lot of stuff though. You see people with tats of, I see people with parks and recreation tats.
That's
a good point. Yeah.
My cousin's got Ron Swanson tatted on his leg.
Wow.
And I'm like, why? Why do you have this?
That's a good point.
I mean, people, it is surreal, like, how they become, like, obsessed.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I don't know, I don't really care too much about Ron Swanson. He was kind of intense, I don't know, and people be like, whoa! And you're like, oh, okay, I didn't realize that
best
was such
character
a...
on television!
No, I was, like, dividing the room.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go into you. I'm going to pass the ball to the, never mind. I was going to try to do a sports metaphor.
Say it. Do it.
I'm going to pass you the ball.
Okay. You're trying and that's what matters.
I'm going to go for a layup here and God, I want to die.
And then you're going to go up for a layup and then Carl's going to rebound it. So the ball does eventually get to him.
Yeah. And let's rebound all the way to the past. Okay. Let's do that.
Okay. Let's rebound to the past.
This is a mess.
tell our audience where you were born, where you grew up. What was your a little bit of your childhood like?
Okay, so I was born in the nice, quiet, quaint little town of Pascagoula, Mississippi.
Whoa!
And
never heard of that town.
It's on the Gulf Coast. It is a hugely it's an industrial town. So it's one of those places that has two very large plants, a Chevron oil refinery, and when I was a kid, it was called Ingalls shipbuilding, but then it like went to like Northrop Grumman. That's where they build naval ships. Like a lot of the naval ships that we use as a country are built in my hometown.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's like a, you know, the kind of the pride of the city and the badge. Everybody works there. If you don't go to college, like after high school, which, you know, it's Mississippi, not everybody does. But if you don't get out and go to college after you graduate high school, you probably end up working at one of those places. Like, there's a lot of turnover, a lot of hiring. I got a lot of family that work at both of the places. That town, you know, small place. It's not one stoplight, but it's a small town, like less than, I think, like 90,000 people or something like that. And
what were the demographics like?
I'm not exactly sure. I think we can Google that. I know I lived in a black neighborhood. It was definitely like on the opposite side of the tracks was the black neighborhood. You know, a lot of black people, a lot of white people. I think when I was there, it was before we had a large influx of Latinx people, like after Hurricane Katrina hit, because there was a lot of jobs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But before that, it was pretty much all I saw was black and white with a sprinkle of Korean people who were down there, like, you know, opening businesses and stuff like that.
Huh. Okay. I Googled the demographics. It's mostly white, which, you know.
I was mostly asking for your experience, not really like the stats.
Numbers
of the,
here. I got some real city, stats but... we can analyze. Yeah. That's interesting. Do you say Koreans? South Koreans? Huh.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
They were down there.
Immigration is pretty cool. Are you in the notable people of the...
I definitely don't think so. I think they forgot that I existed.
Well, I'll add you.
But Jimmy Buffett is in there.
Oh, it says Channing Tatum. Did you know
Channing Tatum lived there for a little bit when he was a kid.
Interesting. Oh, nice. Well, this isn't relevant to anything. Well, yeah. What was your experience growing up there?
My experience was great, honestly. I was there for a short amount of time now that I think about it. I'm 31 now. I was there until I was 9 or 10 years old.
Formative and, years.
Yeah. And, you know, I had good friends. Everybody who lived in the neighborhood knew each other. It was definitely like a village. Like, I would get in trouble if I rode my bike down the street and didn't wave at, like... the neighbor, like they would like Miss Geraldine would come down to my grandma's house and be like, I saw Carl on his bicycle today and he didn't say hi, he didn't speak, and I would get in trouble for that.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's like that type of town.
Where'd you go after that? After you were 10?
I came here. I came to Los Angeles, California. Yeah.
Oh.
And my mom had always wanted to be in the entertainment industry. She's an actor. And so after she graduated college, my parents had me really young. And so I stayed those first few years with my grandma. And then my mom came out here. And during that time, my grandma started to get Alzheimer's. And so I had to come here with my mom. And it was a real different, it was a big culture shock. It was a big change because I came from a place where I was hanging out, like riding bikes with friends and going to the swimming pool and like gone from the house pretty much from 9 a.m. to... you know, the street lights came on 7-8 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And then still, like, even when we went into the house, we would still kind of be in our yards or something like that, like playing. And it was just great. And then I came here and I wasn't allowed to leave the block. I wasn't allowed to leave my apartment building because we lived in a bad neighborhood, you know. And, you know, we lived in a cheaper neighborhood, which happened to be considered a bad neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a real large change. And then when I got to school, it was just like I had never been around Latinx people. I had never gone to a school where the kids just seemed so much more mature in a way because they lived a different lifestyle. That I had, like, I was just talking to my friends about this. When I first got to elementary school, like I was in elementary school where kids were like legit gang members.
Yeah.
Like in elementary school.
Wow.
Like nobody's older than 11 in elementary school. And these kids were legit. Like members of gangs. And that was just a different experience. It was shocking and I didn't like it at first. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to be back home. I really wanted to be with my family. It was like we didn't have no family out here. It was just me and my mom. And it was just tough.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah. Well, do you have any siblings?
I have three younger brothers. Two of them are my dad's children and one is my mom's. And he's the one I'm closest to. Mm-hmm. And he's here. But he's 10 years younger than I am. So
right. So it kind of felt like you were an only child for a good part of your life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that must have felt really isolating to move across the country and then have none of your close friends with you and then feel like you, yeah, it's definitely a culture shock. That makes sense. Were you able to make friends easily, or was it kind of like a struggle for you just being the new kid?
It was new kid struggle, but I also made friends pretty easy. I think I was a goofy kid and kind of gravitated to the other goofier kids. And, you know, I still have some, you know, friends that I met that first year I was here that I'm still friends with to this day.
That's beautiful. And
yeah, those guys are still in my life. It wasn't hard. People used to make fun of my accent and stuff, but that's nothing, you know.
What, did you have like a more southern accent? I acclimated pretty quickly.
Yeah, a real strong southern accent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it wasn't terrible. It wasn't like, I kind of didn't like it because it was just so fast and so big and so like, you know, you heard about the Crips and the Bloods and like stuff like that. And then once I got to middle school, high school age, I was acclimated at that point.
And but it's going from like the slow southern way of life to LA, where it's like nothing is slow here other than just like maybe traffic.
Yeah.
Was your father back in Mississippi?
Yeah, he's back in Mississippi.
Okay. And what was he doing? Was he working at the plants as well?
No, my dad actually is a postal worker.
Okay.
He works for the United States Postal Service.
The most underrated job. Honestly, like, postal workers, I want to have, like, I saw this tweet about how they should change the Brooklyn Nine-Nine to just work in a postal office. And I honestly think I would rather see a show about postal workers than I would about cops, obviously, at this point. But I just feel like postal workers don't get the credit they deserve. They're out here.
No, it's still a federal job. They're essential workers. My dad's been working this whole quarantine. He's a postmaster now.
Oh, wow.
He's a postmaster of his county.
Whoa.
I didn't realize that was the title. That's a pretty cool title.
Yeah, it's cool. I took a picture of his plaque last time. He was like, show this to your Hollywood friends.
Postmaster.
Well, I mean, it is a funny thing that we all like really, I hate to say like we stan a postal worker, but we do because they don't get the respect they deserve. Like they're out here every day delivering our mail for us. Like they keep us connected to the world and then they want to like cut their budgets and like defund the postal service when it's like, these are the people that, they don't beat people in the streets. They are literally just mailing or bringing our mail and risking their lives every day, touching our nasty ass packages from wherever the fuck, Amazon. Yeah.
Literally risking their lives. I think a postal worker just got killed by a racist person.
Are you serious?
I saw that on Instagram. So it's literally risking their lives.
Wow.
And they don't get the fire department, police department.
No.
First responder, because they're not technically first. I wanted to do they train. I guess I gotta kind of ask my dad.
Yeah.
Do y'all get trained in case like you're delivering a package and you see somebody having a heart attack or something? Like,
whoa.
Like, what would happen?
Do they have, like, I wonder if they get like how to deal with it? Because, you know, the whole like stereotype of like dogs hate postal service.
Yeah.
Just delivery. I don't, it's so weird because, you know, my dog doesn't fucking give a shit. So I'm like, okay. But I wonder if they're like actually trained. How to deal with people's pets.
There's also a bunch of, I feel like, funny jokes about, like, your mom fucking the mailman. I wonder how that started. That's a funny joke. But I'm gonna look into the history of that. But no, I think to bring it back like on a semi-serious note, I did see someone, a FedEx worker, posted this Instagram video. He was delivering packages and someone, like, pulled over and spit on him and, like, called him a racial slur. And, that's like a crazy thing right now to be a postal worker or any type of delivery person. That's just like, you're just trying to do your job and you have to go to neighborhoods that maybe don't like you or like, it's just, I don't know. It's a really scary time to be an essential worker, let alone someone that has to like, that doesn't really have protection.
Yeah.
It's not.
Well, shout out to your dad.
Yeah. Shout out to your dad. Shout out. Postmaster Tart.
Yeah. Father's Day is coming up. I just sent him a box of expensive steaks.
Ooh. Nice.
So he's still in.
What, he's going to deliver it to himself. I'm kidding.
Kidding. He's going to see it at the post office. He'll be like, I could just put this in my car, but by law, I have to
rules are rules.
Take it in the truck and put it out in front of my house.
And that's why he's the postmaster.
Yeah. And he's not allowed to touch it while he's on the clock. He can't he has to clock out and go inside the house, change his uniform. And no, I'm just kidding. I don't know.
I was really enthralled by that. I was like, whoa.
I will say this. He had a real cool jacket when I was back home. a jacket and a bucket hat. And I was like, I'm about to take these two things back to LA and I'm gonna rock the shit out of them. I'm about to swag these out. And he was like, you cannot wear that if you're not a federal worker.
That's interesting that they, like, for federal workers, they were like, and part of your uniform is a bucket hat. Like, I've seen them wear bucket hats and I've never thought about it until you just said that.
Not the Qantas hats or whatever those are called. I wasn't going to wear that, but a legit, like, cool bucket hat that had, like, USPS logo on it.
I mean, they have cool outfits. I like their outfits. I like their shorts. I like their whole fucking vibe. God, USPS, man. They know how to dress.
They know how to dress. They know how to dress.
That's brilliant right there.
Yeah.
We might just be able to get them that funding.
Everyone loves merch. Everyone loves merch. We should just do merch for USPS. Donate money to them. All funds go to Postmaster Tart.
I agree.
I'm kidding. Yeah.
Perfect.
Should we
take a quick break? Let's take a quick break.
We'll be right back.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Yeah, we're back with Carl Tart. Okay, so you're in LA, you're middle school, high school. Did you know at this point, well, your mom wanted to be an actress, or was she acting at that time? And did that influence you wanting to go into the entertainment field?
It did the exact opposite.
Oh.
My mom was a struggling actor, like so many of our friends are. You know, people don't be having money like that unless their parents are hooking them up.
Yeah. Yep.
And my mom wasn't getting hooked up by her parents. And on top of that, she had me. So times were tough for us, man. Times were tough. My mom sacrificed a lot to, you know, raise me out here and keep me safe. And yeah, we had to live in some less than perfect areas and things like that. But she always, like, sent me to school on the west side. which, you know, are just better overall schools and stuff like that. And it was tough because, you know, acting jobs come few and far in between. Like, but she would work. My mom would work, and, you know, I remember she would get breaks, and then they would kind of like teeter out. Like, I remember this show called Men Behaving Badly that she like became like a recurring character on, and they got canceled like on her like third episode. And it's just like, damn. So it's just like little stuff. But living like that and how we had to live, how poor we were at times, I was just like, I will never, ever be in this business. And now look at me.
Well, what did you want to do
all
instead
up in this business's ass? Huh?
Well, instead of wanting to be in the business, especially being in LA, what were you thinking of doing instead?
Oh, well, you know, I had a real solid backup plan. Something that fail-proof, honestly. Go to the NBA.
Oh. Of course. Yeah, that's going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That will work.
Yeah.
When nobody knows me, when I'm 900th ranked player in California. But I didn't know. I was going to be a school teacher, honestly.
Wow.
Yeah. I kind of have always kind of wanted to do that because teachers have always been influential in my life and kind of always gave me a break. I wasn't always the easiest student to deal with. Just I wasn't behaviorally bad. I was just disruptive. I talked and joked a lot. I liked having attention from my friends in class.
Yeah, making them laugh and stuff.
Yeah. And so I decided that I was just going to be like a school teacher just so I could give that same energy to some kid that needed it. And I went to college to play basketball for a year in New Mexico. And that didn't work out. And I came back to LA and was like, well, if I'm not playing basketball, I don't really want to be in school.
Right.
In order to be a teacher, you got to get a degree. And so I was like, I guess I got to figure out something else to do. And at that point, people were like, I mean, you've always been like a funny guy. Why don't you try to go into comedy? And I was like, no, that's not real. People don't really do that. Like, no, you just wake up one day and you're Dave Chappelle. like that's not a real thing, because that's kind of how people think about it. Like, I mean, I remember when I first said that I was going to start it, a lot of my friends who had always said I was the funny guy, who had always given me that title and stuff like that, were like, oh, so you think you're funny now? And it's like, no, you thought I was funny. You did this. And so, it was that was when I was like, I guess I'll try this. And then stuff just kind of started working out. The first like year, like I just started getting opportunities, and I was like, it wasn't easy at all, but I was just kind of making a name for myself pretty quickly. And so I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to stick with this. I think I like to do this.
What was that moment, or like, what was the opportunity where you were like, okay, this can work?
I booked the CBS Diversity Showcase, and they always talk about how many people audition for that every year and how few people get into it. And when I did that, I was like, oh, I actually can do this. I can actually, like, this could be something, because a lot of people are going to see me in this show.
Yeah.
And that's when I was, or maybe before that, I started getting on house teams at the Second City.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, well, I'm good enough to do this. I'm good enough to represent this theater.
Yeah.
Like, I guess this is something real. And then the CBS Diversity Showcase came, and I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to be doing.
Yeah.
I'm gonna do my best to make money at this. And that really helped me, like, kind of propel me forward, just by it helped me get auditions and stuff like that.
And was that Second City the first place you went to take classes or train?
Yeah. Yeah. Second City was the first place I went to take classes.
Nice.
And it was, I fell in love with it day one.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I was thinking about doing it, I had been researching all year and seeing, like, like, oh, how do people get on Saturday Night Live? Like, I've always loved that. I've always kind of wanted to be on that. How do people do it? And I thought they were all, I didn't know improv existed. I thought they were all stand-up comedians who are kind of funny, you know?
Yeah.
And so when I started looking at improv, I was like, oh, this is a real thing. Like, I'm down to try this. Like, it looks fun. I was nervous about stand-up because you're just kind of standing up there by yourself. And I was like, oh, this offers like a support system.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And my birthday was coming up. My mom was like, oh, what do you want for your birthday? You're going to be 21 soon. What do you want for your birthday? And I was like, oh, I want to take these improv classes. And my mom, of course, was like, what? I've been trying to get you to do this all your life. Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, now I've stumbled upon it. I think I'm ready to do it now. And she paid for the first class, and I just kind of jumped in. I was like, oh, this is it. Like, first day, I was just like, this is so much fun. Because I definitely went in with reservations. Like, man, this is going to be stupid.
Well, especially dumb. After living your whole life being like, I'm never going to do an entertainment job or whatever.
Yeah.
So, but your mom, you're saying your mom was supportive of the pivot and even was like, as a kid, was encouraging you to explore, like, entertainment, creative stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I acted as a kid, but I like, didn't like it. I didn't like being on set. I didn't like the other kids on set.
I mean, I can't even imagine acting as a child. That's a whole fucking other ballgame.
It was fun sometimes. It was fun to like not have to go to school. Mm-hmm. But then those kids were just so awkward and weird and so like overly mature for their ages. Mm-hmm. It's like, I wanted to play Power Rangers. They're like, I got to call my agent.
It's like Dakota Fanning.
Yeah.
I got to call my agent. That's wild.
But when I stumbled upon it again, she was like, ah, I told you so. And I'm like, no. I just had to figure it out on my own.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, if I was your mom at this point in your life, I'd be like, I told you should. Like, I was right about this. Like, I told you should have done this whole time.
Yeah. So your mom was always encouraging you to kind of like find your own way or like just do what you want?
No.
Oh.
She was strict and she didn't really, she wanted me to do what she wanted me to do.
Okay.
But when I told her that I really didn't want to do the acting stuff when I was a kid, she didn't make me force me to do that.
Right.
Because that is a big undertaking for her too.
Right. But
when it came to stuff like I wanted to do basketball camps and stuff like that, and she didn't see the value in that type of stuff.
I see.
Because that's just not her thing. She doesn't understand like why that's important for the development of a young player. Mm. But I had to take piano lessons and I had to play instruments and I had to do that type of stuff. And that was like non-negotiable because she saw the value of that. She saw the value of knowing how to play the piano. She saw the value of knowing music and things like that. But I'm like, but I want to go to basketball camp this summer. Mm. Can we take the piano lesson music money and let me go to this basketball camp at SC or whatever? Like, no, I don't know. What are you doing that for? Like, she just didn't like, in some ways I was upset about that. Cause she was like, you're on a basketball team at your school. Why do you need extra? Like, cause you need extra if you want to be good.
You gotta learn those extra skills.
Yeah.
So her priorities were more like the arts, the creative stuff, and like.
Yeah.
I mean, like I took piano lessons as a kid, and my parents are really strict, but I ended up not really putting my heart into it, and now I'm really bad at the piano. So part of me wishes I paid more attention and like stuck to it, or like I feel like the things that my parents were really strict on are kind of the things that I now wish I paid more attention to. Do you feel that way at all, or not really? Do you?
A little bit. Yeah. A little bit, because I do love music a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And my high school that I went to Hamilton High School, which is on the west side of LA, and I was in the music academy. I was there for music, but I didn't pay as much as I wasn't paying attention. And I can still feel around, but I think I'm the same way. I didn't have my heart in it because my mom forced it on me so much, and it wasn't what I wanted to do.
Exactly.
And so I'm just like, I'm not gonna practice. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not gonna do this. And I watched my peers just go so much further than me, but also they weren't on sports teams at school. They did piano.
You had a different passion that you wanted to see
and
yourself improving.
It was definitely probably angsty teen revolt too. And so I give my mom credit for a lot of stuff, but I'm not giving her credit for the piano thing. And I won't say I like she told me so, but I do wish that I could like sit down at a piano at a Macy's and be like, this one's for all the lovers out there. And just kind of like play a song. I do wish I could do that in a way.
Yeah.
But also like my mom really did not listen to me at all when I was telling her like, I would much rather play sports. Right. I have a natural ability. I need to learn how to do this better. Can we do this more? And she just didn't understand it. She just thought like, you play for your high school. Like, that's enough.
It was a hobby for her. It was more just like a,
Well, I had the opposite. My parents were forcing me to play like basketball and stuff. And I was like, I did camp because I grew up in the Bay Area. I did camps with the Warriors, which they were not great at the time. and stuff like that. And I would just be like, I would not like to do this. So I had to play a bunch of basketball, and I kept dislocating my thumbs because I was trying to be a great rebounder, but I was just a fool. Like, I was just clumsy. So my thumbs would always dislocate, and then I would cry because they'd have to pop them back in. Anyway, I will never forgive my parents for that. So I hope they're listening. That was painful for me. I was also very small, and it was like a bunch of, and I was in the like Oakland, Berkeley. So it was just like these great fucking kids playing basketball. And I was just like, da, 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 trying to rebound and getting hurt left and right, to a point where one of my teammates was like, Anna, like, just try not to rebound. Like, you're just going to get hurt. And I was like, man, fuck you.
My parents didn't fucking value physical fitness like that. They didn't like, they kind of use the piano or even just like video games or when we like nerded out on anything as a way to keep us indoors and sheltered. So I don't know. I kind of wish my parents, I mean, like, I now I obviously, I feel like, again, anything your parents push on you, you hate.
Yeah.
So then it's like, I kind of, it's just like, you don't really appreciate it until you're an adult, if you do at all. But okay. So you are 21, you're doing improv. Is this where you kind of like find your voice? Like, do you like, how do you pivot to other entertainment fields? Like, how did you, you were on the CBS showcase. Like, take us through a little bit of these early stages in your career.
I'm still trying to work on finding a voice to this day, but I definitely kind of found my way in comedy and kind of, it kind of filled that void that I thought that basketball had left, you know, like I was like, oh, this is something. Cause there was a thing. One of the reasons why, when I was talking about never getting to go to those camps and stuff like that and get really better, is that was another thing where I kind of realized when I got into comedy and how much energy I put into it and how much hard work I put into it, that I wasn't really working hard on anything else I was doing in my life. Mm-hmm. Like, so I thought I was working hard on basketball just because me and my friends would go and play every day, but I wasn't. Like, I could have been better at that. I could have been better at music. I could have done these things better. But when I got into comedy, it was finally something that I was like, oh, this is what I really want to be doing. I think it was because I got that positive reinforcement from it.
This is what it feels like to care about something and to like, know I'm good at it and to have people tell me I can do this. Yes. That's a great feeling to feel.
It's a really great feeling. Yeah. It's a really great feeling. And I think that's what drove me to be like, okay, I'm going to try to be the best at this I can possibly be.
I love you know, there are similarities though. I think you liking basketball and you liking improv, there's like a team element that I think maybe you gravitate towards. 100%. That you like kind of, you like this like fostering your trust with your teammates. Like it's like, it's all about trust, about like being able to pass the ball and you're open versus like being yes and. Like, I know that's like a silly like analogy, but I think it makes sense.
And it makes total sense.
Rebounds, there's a coach. The yes and.
There's a coach.
Yeah.
And there are rules to improv. Like, they're basically like plays that you have to run to make a set successful.
Yeah.
Especially when you're doing forms like the Herald and things like that. Like, there are things that you have to do, just like in basketball. There are plays that you run to be successful.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of it is like, you know,
the team sport.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, okay. I want to talk a little bit about diversity, though, in improv, because I think we've heard a lot about, especially recently, like, just, I don't know, a lack of diversity, or maybe even just like pigeonholing certain like races into like groups, or being, I've heard a lot of stories about how people were like the one person of color in a group or the one Black person in a group. Did you ever experience that, or did you find it pretty easy to like find your people?
No, I experienced that 100%.
Okay.
Yeah. And that is something that I think all of us experienced until we started banding together to do stuff together. We always joke about my team that I'm on called White Women. You guys know Iffy.
Yeah.
It's
a great name for a team.
Yeah. We have a good
not
time.
White women. Yeah.
Yeah. All Black guys, but we were all kind of like the one Black dude on all these indie improv teams. And we all had this same struggle of acclimating to a white space, which I think people of color, Black people especially, like, we just know how to do that. We always have more white friends than our white friends have Black friends.
Mm,
like, And that's been my whole life. And, and improv was super white when I got into it. It's changed so much since I've been in. I'm 10 years in now. It's changed a ton just since I've been into it. And I like to think that my peers are kind of what is leading that charge of like people who are now hearing about improv. Like I said, I didn't know what improv was. Mm-hmm. I genuinely didn't. And I was a comedy nerd. I knew every single stand-up comedians. I knew their famous jokes. I watched SNL, Mad TV, and Living Color, like all like Def Jam, Comic View, Premium Blend, everything on Comedy Central. Like I was a huge comedy nerd growing up, and I did not know what improv comedy was.
It's very white space.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was at the time, especially.
Yeah. It just wasn't a thing that Black people were doing. And when I was searching for a school to go to, like when I was researching, I was like, okay, so there's this place called The Groundlings in LA. Let me go look at their alumni list. And at the up until that point, there was only two Black names that I recognized and only three Black names altogether.
Wow.
And it's funny, I'm friends with all three of those people now. And they were the only alumni. It was Jordan Black, Phil Lamar, and Daniel Gaither. That I was like, oh, I know Phil Lamar and Daniel Gaither. Like, they're on Mad TV. I know who those guys are. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who Jordan Black was at the time. He's a writer. He's a great guy. Then I went to the Second City's website, and they had their website kind of set up like a college brochure where they put all the diversity on the front page. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, okay, so I'm seeing visible faces. I'm also friends with all those Black people now. It was Sam Richardson and Edgar Blackman were on stage, were on the main stage at the time when I was looking up like improv class, when I was doing that research. And people like Amber Ruffin and people like, you know, all these people like that have gone on to do great things. But I chose to go to that place because their diversity was a little bit more visible. And then when I went to take the class, it definitely was very white in that room. There was only a few Black faces. I got into a class with a Black dude. We were in the same class. We went through the whole program together. His name is Ace Gibson. And I met other Black friends while I was there, like Shoni Francis and Dwayne Colbert and Aqua Dan. So like people who came in and were all still great friends and stuff. Yeah. And it was a totally white. When I went over to UCB, it was a boys club.
Yeah.
That's all it was. I met Ronnie Adrian, who's on White Women with me. I met him while I was still at Second City before I went over to UCB, but I was immersing myself so much into the community that we met at a jam and we became friends.
Yeah.
Kind of sized each other up at first and then was like, let's be friends. Cause it also breeds that there can only be one of us mentality in us.
Yeah.
And so of course we had to size each other up at first and be like, hold on, man, I'm funnier than you. No, I'm funnier than you. It's like, wait, why don't we both be funnier than all of them?
That's the most unfortunate part about not only like tokenizing someone, but like making someone feel like they have to, like, are you a minority, like as far as your voice in your industry, but then you're competing against people that are also doing the same thing because you think just by the way it's established, like there can only be one person on the lineup of that is Black. There can only be this, there can be that.
You're fighting to be the tokenized person. Like, what the fuck?
We're fighting really to be a person that doesn't get that much respect. And it's unfortunate. Me and him bonded over just like having like similar movie references and things like that. Stuff that white people do in improv all the time. Like white people are constantly referencing Star Wars and Spaceballs and stuff like that. And we have to know all that stuff.
Yeah.
But if I remember back when I first started doing improv, when everybody kind of sucked, and this doesn't happen to me anymore, but back then when we all first started and we'd be on improv teams and stuff like that, if I said anything that was remotely not white culture specific, I would get reprimanded for going Black.
What? They would say that? Like,
yeah, there's like, well, or the scene would change to now this is about me being Black, or this is about me eating grits as opposed to what the scene was originally. And that's because nobody was good improvisers.
My mouth is ajar. What?
Yeah. Like it happened because if I said, "Oh yeah, I'm just having grits for breakfast," the scene now becomes about that as opposed to just not even paying attention to that and letting the scene be what it was going to be in the first place, letting the original game, like,
Because it's not a quote unquote people thing, like a white relatable thing. Like, yes. I think it's so infuriating. And I relate to a little bit what you're saying as like, we have to understand all this white people shit. Like, I still don't understand Mighty Python.
Monty Python.
I don't fucking care about it. It's too white. Oh, I don't care about it, but I have to know it. No, but you know what I mean? Like, we're supposed to understand all these white references, and I can't even imagine being a performer and being shot down for a reference that you probably relate to and probably people that look like you relate to.
Mm-hmm.
That's infuriating.
I
mean,
yeah, that's true. Yeah. I didn't realize how much I was supposed to know about Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that is not a thing in Iranian culture. My parents did not let me watch these movies. Yeah. I don't know what like, none of that shit means anything to me. But then people like really get upset if you've never seen it.
Yeah. Never seen Monty Python. Never seen fucking like Austin Powers. I don't fucking care. Like, I don't, whatever.
I've seen all these movies. And
I mean, because you had to or because
I had
you.
To. Yeah. Well, a little bit of both. Austin Powers is a funny movie. You should check it out.
I should. I haven't seen a lot of stuff.
Also, Back to the Future is a great trilogy as well. However, the fact that I know about that, but when I tell them, when I make a reference to a movie that's very popular in Black culture, like The Five Heartbeats, it's the one that I always go to when I'm telling this story. They don't know what the hell that is.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, when I met Ronnie, me and Ronnie would bond over the Five Heartbeats jokes all the time,
mm-hmm.
because it's a movie about an old it's a fictional soul group from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, kind of like a
Isn't like that Robert Townsend?
Yeah, it's a Robert Townsend movie.
I randomly saw that once on TV.
It's great. It's so great, and all Black people have seen it and they know it and love it. And
but you make a good point about it being unbalanced. Like, you're supposed to know all this white culture, because. Why? Because they're the dominant culture. What? I don't know. Like, it's so annoying. But then the minute it's reversed, it's like not acceptable. Like, they don't go out of their way to understand anything that they don't have to.
They would get legitimate mad. They would go like, you're going Black. Like, you're changing the style of the show. And it's like,
well,
what? So you guys were going white when you mentioned, I've never seen The English Patient. Like, when you made that. I've never seen that movie.
Yeah.
Well, no, but that's like a normal movie. Like, everybody's seen that. That's mm-hmm. what they say. Hmm. And I go, well, in my world, everybody has seen this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Their version of normal is not normal.
Have you heard of white supremacy? You need to know what our movies are.
Yeah.
What a mess.
But those conversations weren't being had back then. I just had to get into that. So when White Women formed in 2013, when we started doing these shows and we all kind of had this similar experience, we all were kids who grew up kind of nerdy and square in the hood,
mm-hmm.
and in impoverished neighborhoods and stuff like that. And we're kind of always these goofy kids, kind of like outliers, but still were products of our environment. And we all had these movie references and we all had these song references. And when we did our shows, the first, like, we just didn't have bad shows. It was so much fun. Even if the show wasn't the best improv, we just talked to each other on a different wavelength. It was like a connection that we all had.
But that's probably what white people feel all the time.
All the time. All the time.
That's crazy. I want to talk more about how you guys formed White Women, but let's go to a quick commercial break. We'll be right back.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women. And this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
And we're back with Carl Tart.
At the break, I asked Carl if I could ask him about Boom Chicago and Amsterdam. Mostly I'm curious, okay, so like how did you hear about it and like how did you get into it? And then what was it like being a Black man performing improv in Amsterdam of all places?
So I heard about it because there is very few opportunities to be paid to do improv in the world. And the second city in Chicago and Toronto and Boom Chicago, the only opportunities to be paid to do improv. And so, and Chicago, the producers in both of those places were all like, you're not going to get hired. You're an LA product. You'd have to come here and take the classes. And we just have a Chicago voice and a Chicago way. And you'll just never be able to fit that voice. And you'll never be as funny as the people that we have here. And so it's no reason to even try. But this Boom Chicago place would come to LA and do auditions. And so I auditioned at the suggestion of some of the alumni who had come out of there.
Yeah.
Amber Ruffin and Brendan Hunt and people like that. Colton Dunn. And I auditioned and I got the job. And I was, at the time in my life, I was like still living at home with my mom. And that was a tough relationship. I'm like 24 years old. And like in Southern culture, like the children, especially the boy children, out of the house at 18. But she kind of understood it's like that's almost impossible for me in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Like that's that like that's like for our generation, like the millennials who are getting shat on right now. Yeah. I don't think they realized like for us moving out of the house was not an option. Like until you had like a really steady thing going.
Honestly, if my parents lived in LA, I'd live with them right now. If my parents had a house here, I would live there. I would not pay rent in this city. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it anymore. I was like, it's not enough. It's just not enough space. Like my mom has kind of a smaller house and I'm just too big of a guy to be living with my mother.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I was like, you know what? I'm going to try this. Like I've never left the country. I'm going to go see what this is all about. And the way that they painted it, it was a really dope experience. Like from how the people who had been there talked about it and stuff like that. I got over there. I did not experience that. I had a bad experience there, and it was because it was a huge culture shock for me coming from Mississippi and Los Angeles, where Amsterdam is kind of like New York in a way. It's a very small city, and it's packed with people. It's so many people that live there, and the people are kind of rude. They like to say that it's direct, but it's rude.
Yeah.
And they just say things to you, and they're not really, like, the racism over there was different, but still very, very real. And also I was going over there as an American. This is during the Obama years, but they would always, they love to like talk about George Bush and how Americans screwed that. And I would say, like, hey, man, I'm a black dude. I'm not a part of that. I'm not a part, black people didn't really vote for George Bush. I didn't, and I wasn't even old enough to vote when he was running. So the first president I voted for was Barack Obama. But like, stop. I became like oddly patriotic because Europeans, they envy us so much. But also, you know, we do stupid shit. And so it's, they have talking points, but they want to be us so bad. Like, they want to be here. And so I just had a hard time adjusting to the city. And I'm not the type of person, especially back, well, back then more than now, I'm more mature now. But back then I was like, hey, man, you want to argue about this? We can argue about it. We can fight about it. Like, you're not going to just talk shit about my home country constantly to my face, and I'm just supposed to be like, yeah, you're right. America sucks.
Like, they were just waiting for an American to come so they can like unload all their grievances.
All while sitting and listening to hip hop music and wearing Nike shoes. It's like, you want to be here. You want to be us. Like, and people would say certain things, like, they just didn't understand. Like, no, it is not racist what I'm saying. This is the truth. This is this, this, and it's just like, you don't know that they were so headstrong. And it, I'm only saying this about Amsterdam and the Netherlands, maybe. But I would also go and perform. We would do corporate shows and stuff like that in smaller towns and countryer, more bumpkin towns, worse English speakers. Like, and in those places, it would get bad. To where one time I had to walk off stage because it was these high school kids just kept shouting the N-word. I was like, I'm not performing. I'm not doing this. Like, this sucks. Like, and I was mad at
when
my
bosses.
When
you were on stage?
But they, because they didn't know. Like, they were just like these like kind of bumpkin Dutch kids who like, in Amsterdam, people are like, it's harder to live there. It's a more expensive place. So more of the people who live there are more like highbrow, kind of like richer. They speak English. Like, speaking English is a badge of like privilege over there, kind of like. If you speak English really well,
and that especially means you were educated and had money to get educated,
But in these places where that wasn't a thing, man, these people were dumb. They were dumb. They were just as racist. These hick people in another country, and I was just like, I'm not performing. And I was like, I went back and I like yelled at my bosses, like, why did y'all send me there? Like, why did y'all make me do that show, and not the white cast members? Like, that sucked. That was a terrible experience for me. I'm from Mississippi, and I haven't had an experience like that.
What did they say?
Oh, no, it's not that bad. It's probably just this one time. They've never done that. They've never. And so I didn't like working there very much.
How long was it? How long were you there?
I was there for a year.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, I thought this was like a little fucking summer at most. A year?
No, I was there for a year. The longest year of my life to date. it was pretty bad.
And then you got out. How do you you just quit, or do you just like finish your contract? Or
I finished my contract. Once my contract was over, I was like, I am going home. They definitely they like have like a check in talk with you and be like, we'd love you to stay. I'd be like, I'd love to not. Like, I'm going home, and there's nothing that you can convince me to stay here.
Was there a silver lining of like, did you save any money? Did you like, was it?
No, that's now that's off air.
Subject. Okay, sorry.
No. It's not that bad. I just don't want to like get sued. But the answer is
that sucks, man.
The answer is no. I did not save any money because I wasn't being paid enough to save money.
Wow. That's really unfortunate. I'm so sorry you had a year of that. That is.
But again, I always like to give this disclaimer. It's just my experience. Everybody, there are a lot of people who
You were saying some of the alumni had a great
time. They love it. They were also there at a very different time. They were there in like the early 2000s when it was like a real boom and before the economy crashed and stuff like that. I went in the early aughts and it just wasn't it just wasn't popping for me. And it was just an older business and it just wasn't as fun.
Right.
And but yeah.
That's crazy to
just
be.
Just my experience though.
But that is crazy to be from the South and then go and live in like a neighborhood in LA that you had to like struggle in a little bit, and then the first time a very racist experience that you had is in Amsterdam. Like, that's crazy. That's just, it's everywhere. You're right. It's like, there's hicks everywhere.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I see people, you know, saying it's like, America's fucked up right now. I'm just going to move to Amsterdam and blah, blah, blah. Like, you don't want to go there.
Yeah. It's everywhere. You see France. You see, I mean, racism is just rampant. It's not
American. I went to France. Problem. It was racist there too.
Yeah. It's very racist. Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you for telling us your honest experience. And I'm sorry you had to experience that.
That's, I mean, it's worth talking about. People go like, America's so racist. And it's like, the world is racist.
The world is racist.
The whole world is taught that skin color depicts your, who you are. And it's
like your worth. Yeah.
Yeah. And as you know, as rough as it is here, as scary as it is, as ignorant as it is, this is the only place I want to be.
Yeah.
Like, this is the only place in the world I want to be.
That's a really important thing. Can you explain why, though? Because I want to get into that a little bit, if you're able to.
I mean, I would say from my perspective, it's just a comfortability thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a free country. I've gone to places where it just a lot of the black people that I met in the Netherlands were like very intrigued by my personality and how boisterous I was and how kind of free I was. And here I'm considered to be a more even keeled person, more like on the shyer side when I'm out in like a strange, you know, thing. But over there, they were like, man, you're just so like, we don't act like that. It just wasn't their personality over there.
They're more reserved.
They're more, a lot more reserved.
Careful, yeah.
Yeah. And that came from just their relationship with the white people, because a lot of black people there from like the Dutch Antilles and Suriname and places like that, that were like all taken over by the Netherlands, by Holland. And
they kind of,
it was a different experience.
That's a really interesting thing just to realize. I mean, Anna and I talk about this sometimes, but our personalities are influenced by where we grow up so much. And so like, I'm sure Anna can relate to this. Like me and my sisters have a much different personality than the cousins that we are the only cousins that grew up in America. And we're louder. We're more free. We have tattoos. It's like, where, how you are raised really does influence you. And there is an element of that freedom here. You know, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Anna, I know you're from Iran. Shireen, are you from Iran?
I'm from Syria. My parents are Syrian, so I'm Arab. Okay. But they're very similar cultures. I think we don't realize, like, to go back to racism not being like an American problem. Like, I remember growing up, and I can pass as white, but I'm tanner than my sisters. And so, I was the tan one. And that was like a low key insult when I was growing up. And like, I would be afraid of the sun. I was terrified of getting tan because I didn't want to be like quote unquote uglier or like whatever. So like, there are these little like micro things that you grow up with and you really embody them when you're a kid. And then you grow up as an adult. And then you think that it's just like a racism, like white versus black thing. But no, it's like our discomfort with skin color is so embedded in us in every culture. And it's so, I don't know. I think that's like the real internal work that everyone has to do right now. Not just, I mean, mostly white people, but everybody.
It all comes from European colonialism.
Yes.
Yeah. So white people it all stems from Britain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some like Britain. Chubby, fat fingered fuck was like darker skin bad. And it's like, go fuck yourself to the end of time. Like, I got lucky because my mom has very pale skin, you know, but my dad is very dark. And people in Iran would fucking give my mom shit and be like, why did you marry such a dark man? Mm-hmm. And I got very lucky that from a young age, like, I would overhear this when we were in Iran. I'd be like, why is everyone always like talk about dad's skin being so dark?
You pick up on these things.
And my mom was very, you know, my mom's a very good person, but she'd always just be like, don't listen to this shit. It doesn't mean it. It's just talk. Mm-hmm. These people are just talking to talk. They don't, none of that means anything. And I was very lucky from a very young age that I learned, like, it doesn't fucking matter. And then, of course, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area in a, you know, kind of a lower income community. And so I got very comfortable at a very early age to be like, I don't give a shit about any of this. Like, I know, you know, I always remember my mom saying, it's all talk. That's it. That's all it is. It's talk. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And I think you just need these. That's why it's always like, talk to your family members, like talk to your kids, like just tell them this shit is not right. It's all a fucking social construct made by chubby ass fingered British dudes. I always think of Prince Charles's fucking chubby ass hands out, like, you motherfucker.
But it's interesting because you pick up on these things as when you're a kid, not even realizing it. Like, it doesn't have to be said to you, but like, I remember growing up and my Like, you, like, cultures are obsessed with European features. Like, my aunt, for example, married a blue-eyed man. My dad has blue eyes. And that was a feature that they talked about when they got together. Like,
yeah.
Oh, because I want my children to have blue eyes. Or, like, this is a mark on my checklist kind of thing. And it's just a crazy thing to think about now. But when you're a kid, you just, like, absorb all these things as normal.
Yeah. And colorism is real. I went through it a ton. I remember my mom got really upset with me when I was a kid because I said I wanted to have a light-skinned baby so it wouldn't go through what I've gone through.
Yeah.
And she got really upset with me. And my mom's a very beautiful woman. She was always like, don't say stuff like that. Do not say stuff like that. Like, I'm attracted to dark-skinned men. You see your dad. You see you. Mm-hmm. Like that. Like, and it was just like very much like, I had such a complex about being dark skinned. And yeah. You know, even to this day in black culture, it's still like a joking
it's still
thing.
A thing.
It's yeah. still a thing yeah. about dark skin, light skin. I'm always seen as more aggressive.
But even up until recently, like the most famous black celebrities were kind of on the lighter side. You know what I mean? Like it was more palatable to kind of be a light skinned black person than it was to be a darker skinned black person.
It was definitely more. I mean, think about like Michael Jackson and Prince, like who were like some of the, and you can go back even further than that with like dark, like lighter skinned celebrities. They were just easier to market.
Yeah.
Have you ever read the story of the DeBarges? And they were just like, oh, that was like they almost were white. And that's how they sold so much. Mm-hmm. And
I mean, even people like Rihanna and Beyonce, like they're beautiful, but there is an element to them that's like more marketable. Like they have lighter eyes or they have lighter skin. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not as like it's they have an ability to not make white people afraid for whatever reason.
I think about that a lot with like the Lizzo thing versus Megan Thee Stallion. Two very strong women. Mm-hmm. Two, like when I say why you like Lizzo so much, well, she's a strong woman. She tells it like it is, and she's not afraid of men, and she's not this, and she's like real. Like, and I'm like, okay, but what about Megan Thee Stallion? Oh, I'm not really familiar with.
Right.
I was like, she's just as feminist.
She's
always talking about scamming guys.
Yeah.
But that's not palatable for people because there's like this edge to it that they can't handle. They're like, ooh, I don't know about that. Yeah. I don't know about that. Is that the song Savage on TikTok? It's like you guys are all doing it. At least acknowledge the artist that you're dancing
that
to.
That song
her music.
Is everywhere. Like, but it goes back to how you experience in improv is that you're going black. You're too black. It's like, you know, that just makes me so mad. That makes me so mad.
I just don't
like that. Well, okay. We're kind of winding down to the end of this episode, and I have a lot more questions for you, so you're going to have to come back.
Should we talk about white women real quick?
Let's end there.
So we started, like I said a little bit earlier, we were all kind of like the one black guy on every indie white team. And UCB does a Black History Month show every February. And Colton Dunn, you guys know who Colton is.
Yes.
He's on Superstore and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Great guy. He set up, basically like put a bunch of black people together. Like you get a bunch of black people in the community and kind of mix us all up to work together on a sketch or something like that. And he put together this group of those guys. And they were like, hey, that was really fun. Should we start a group? Would you guys be interested in starting an improv and sketch group? And this is before I came over to UCB. And Ronnie, who I had known already, was like, oh, yeah, I got this guy there's this guy at Second City who's really funny. We should bring him on. And that's how we kind of formed. And it was just like kismet from the beginning.
Yeah.
It was really cool. And we're still going strong 7 years later.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to go back to something we said before the break of like having that ease with your partners is something that, or like just like that, it's like kismet, but also you understand all the jokes and you understand your language and everything. Yeah. It's like what white people have been experiencing this entire time, not even like just taking it for granted that what they think is normal is just their experience.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that was something that you are doing.
I do like that. And you don't have to explain shit. If you don't know the reference, educate yourself.
Yeah. And we don't even do that because we're all such experienced improvisers within the UCB style and within the style that they play there. Me, Ronnie, and Zeke have all been on Harold Night and ASCAT and things like that. So we know how to play. We just are. What I love about this group the most is that, like, sometimes with younger all something teams, all Black, all Asian, all Hispanic, like whatever it is, they kind of, you know, are so anxious to be like free and and using all the references like that they want. Like every scene on the new all Black team, as soon as they come out, they go, "Oh, I'm doing something Black and watching a Black TV show and this Black." And it's like, that's great. And I understand why you want that, because you feel like there's a absence of that in the mainstream, if you will, improv. And there absolutely is. But we are so experienced, like such experienced improvisers, that our shows, people can watch our shows and go, oh, that was just really good, smart improv.
Yeah.
And they all happen to be Black. And we're not running from our Blackness. We're not running from it. We acknowledge it. The names that we choose to use are more Black-leaning names. The subject matters may be stuff that we've all gone through and stuff, but we aren't doing it. We're not
normalizing Black improv.
We're normalizing doing
good improv. You're normalizing the idea that there could be all Black team. That's what I think is important. Like, it shouldn't just be like, oh, this is a Black team over here. That should just be, oh, this is a team.
This is a team.
It happens to be all Black.
That is.
But good. I think it's a really important thing to just normalize it more than anything. It should make it seem like because it is. It should be normal.
It shouldn't continue to be tokenized. Like, and see, we do have a Black team.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
it's how I feel about the show Insecure. Insecure is incredible to me because everyone I know watch, like every type of person I know, every race I know watches it. They normalize their lives. It's like not like a quote unquote Black show. It's just a good fucking show and everyone watches it, and it's just normalizing Black people to people that aren't Black, which is so, like, it's just the most simple thing, but it's really important.
And I think there's a thing with shows like Insecure and Atlanta and things like that. It's like, hey, guess what? We are normalizing this for you, but also there is absolutely no way to run from it, because sometimes they'll give you, like, white people will say, okay, fine. You know what? You have your all Black thing. But as soon as you start going too Black, we're tuning out. And it's like, hey, man, our experience is this. So we fall in love. We get hurt. We cry. We do all this same stuff. And we all have to do it while going through what it means to be a Black person in this country. So. We have to go to the bank and we have to, like, we just have to do it as a Black person. And that's going to come up. You can't avoid that. You can't avoid the idea of what it means to be a Black person in this country. And I think a lot of people are finally opening their eyes, willfully opening their eyes now that they are forced to, because everybody's stuck in their house.
Yeah.
But you have to see it, and you have to understand that. You can watch a show and you go, oh, that show. I mean, nobody would say this now because it would be extremely faux pas. But white people have said things like, it's a Black show. It's too Black for me. It's like, it's not, they're not alienating you. They're doing the same things that you do every day. They're waking up. They're going to work. They're sitting in traffic. They're listening. They just are doing it as a Black person.
Yeah.
So their commute to work might be interrupted by police. It might be interrupted by an old white lady yelling some racist shit. It might, like, that's real for us. And that's the thing that I do love about shows like Insecure, and what I do give credit to my team for, is, like, everything is going to be done through a Black lens because we are Black people. However, we're still going to do improv the way we were taught by the school.
Yeah.
And we're going to do that to the best of our ability.
Yeah,
I think it's a really good, really good place to end, I think, is just, like, realizing that if you're a fan of, especially if you're a fan of something and you aren't, like, if you're a fan of Insecure and you aren't Black, like, you have to realize, like, that's just, it's, you're right, like, people are just living their, they're trying to live their fucking lives, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I will say there's something, I like watching all, like, the behind the scenes or, like, special features of Insecure. And there was one of them where Issa Rae was saying that there was a white writer that didn't understand a joke until she saw it filmed, like until she saw the episode. And Issa Rae was saying, sometimes there are things that are just for us, us meaning Black people, not me personally. But I really held on to that. And I really think it's a really beautiful thing because I kind of felt that way when I was watching Rami, because they don't translate all the Arabic. Yeah. And there are some jokes that only like only Arabic speakers will understand. And I think when you have shows that are depicting marginalized groups, those little moments are so powerful to me. Like I can't really describe the feeling of like hearing Arabic or like Arabic music on Rami. And so I kind of, not like it's not completely the same at all, but those little moments that are just for the audience, I think are really powerful because white people just have to like go along with it. And then they'll understand. You know what I mean? Am I kind of making sense?
It's like we have been going through that for so long. Yeah. Certain reference. It's just like we have, it's like for once, it's like, yeah, well, that one's for us. Get over it. Move it along.
Exactly. This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for being so open and honest about your life. Thank you for being on our show. For those of us, for those of the audience that don't know you, where can people find you on the internet?
I am on Twitter and Instagram at DammitCarl, DammitCarl.
Nice.
DammitCarl.
Yeah.
DammitCarl. Two M's. Flagrant. Two M's, like Eminem.
And flagrant ones, of course.
And the flagrant ones. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Subscribe.
Yeah.
Subscribe to the flagrant ones. Listen to some basketball talk that ain't always just about basketball. Like this week, because there's no basketball going on, we're talking about the movie Moneyball, which I just realized, just remembered I have to watch.
Nice. I haven't seen it.
Watch it, Shireen.
That's the one with Brad Pitt?
Yeah. Okay. Watch it.
Okay. I watched that.
I've heard good things.
Because it's about the A's.
From white people.
And Oakland. And I was like, maybe I should understand more about where the team of where I'm from.
It's a good movie. Y'all should watch it. It's more than just baseball. It is a movie about baseball statistics, but it's a good movie. And it's Brad Pitt.
It is. I thought it was a good movie. I learned a lot. And maybe if I watch again, I'll be like really into stats and I'll come back and be like, Carl, you should be doing stats on the
floor. You should be doing stats, baseball stats. Yeah. No, it's, everybody loves Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt is a king.
Yeah, he's a king.
I mess with Brad Pitt.
I mess with Brad Pitt too.
And I got some Farsi I want to speak to you.
Okay, please.
Salam Eskada.
Oh, okay.
Salam. What does that mean?
Hello?
Hello? What does Eskada mean?
I mean, are you trying to say Salam? Oh, wait. Salam alaikum?
No. I know that.
Okay.
That's Arabic too.
Eskada?
Yeah.
Escada? I don't. What is that trend?
Maybe I'm saying it wrong. How about this? Okay. Sanjob.
Sanjob?
Yeah.
What? Who taught you this stuff?
Squirrel.
Yeah, I just thought what I was expecting you to say.
All right, how about this?
Who taught you how to say squirrel?
Berenj and Kare.
On a berenj, on a rice, yes.
Kare
is butter, yeah.
Yeah, so rice and butter.
Wow, teaching you amazing. I did not expect this twist.
Yeah.
Goje
is like a, how do you say it in English? Goje is a...
Plum, white plum, right?
Yeah. Oh, there you go. White plum. Hmm.
Wow, he's schooling you in Farsi.
Well, there's certain things I don't...
I'm kidding.
Not good at like translating it back to English because my brain is so there's things I just don't think about in English like ever.
Are you teaching yourself Farsi?
No, my friend Peter Banifaz, who y'all gotta have on the podcast.
I followed
his career.
Yeah, and he is he tells me words.
Yeah, I would love to have him on the show.
And I asked him how to say, because in Mississippi, we eat squirrel with rice and butter. I asked him how to say, ask me what's for dinner, and I'll say, Sanjov, Berenj, and Kare.
That's really funny.
You guys,
like that's
actual, like, people eat squirrel?
Oh, yeah, people eat squirrel.
Wow.
Never had squirrel.
What does it taste like?
Nasty.
Fair.
Nah, I don't like it, but people like it.
Yeah.
I was truly like shook. When you said Sanjob, I was like, no, he couldn't possibly say it. Why would he be saying that?
What a random thing to know.
Really wasn't, I really wasn't ready for that one. You had me shook for a second.
There you go. I'm full of surprises.
Follow up with me about what the first, the salam, what you were saying was, because I'm I'm curious.
Salam Escada.
Escada. Salam Escada. Huh.
Huh.
Actually, let me think about that. Maybe I'm just not connecting it. Salam Escada. Escada.
Is it how are you, or is it like a? Is it a?
Hey, Baba.
Hey, Baba. I always say hey, Baba. That's how we make fun of my dad. Because yeah. My dad always goes, hey, Baba, when he's stressed or annoyed. And then so we all just make fun of him. Hey, Baba.
It is pretty
it's like
cool.
Old Persian man anger noise.
Yeah.
Phrase.
Well, because in Arabic, too, we call my parents Mama and Baba, but they also respond back, Mama and Baba. And that's like very particular to only a few languages, I think. But like my sister, her fiance is a white man, a white person. And he always got so weirded out. Like he doesn't, when my mom would call us Mama or my dad would call us Baba, it's like a weird thing that I don't think a lot of people don't really get. So that makes, I don't know if that,
it makes sense.
That makes sense. Yeah. But I think it's really cute. Like it goes on to everything, like aunties or uncles or even your grandparents, they call you the same name you call them. Like yeah. I call my grandma Tete, she calls me Tete. Jiddo's grandpa, he calls me Jiddo. It's like yeah. The same thing with like your aunties, like
that's
your khale, khale, amme, whatever.
I do that now to my pets where I call them mama.
Yeah.
Persian moms will call you, or even like Arabic moms will call you mama.
Yeah.
Like mama ni. So then I call my kids mama ni, even I mean, my kids, my dog and my cat. But like yeah. And I just do
I
it.
I love that about that language. I will say it. Something I am envious about Farsi though in particular is the word June. I love the word June. Mm. Like just like saying like Anna June or Shireen June. It's
Carl
like
June.
It's like this sweet June. Little like hug after a name. I just love it so much. And it's only in Farsi. I really like
yeah,
that.
You should tell Peter to only call you Carl June moving.
Okay. Yeah.
Is there something, maybe I'm wrong about this, but this guy, I had a Lyft driver one night who was asking me for cash to get gas. Mm. And I'm like, that's not my responsibility, sir.
Yeah.
You have to do that. And he kept going, Buddy John. Buddy John, is that the same as
John?
June?
Yeah, the same concept. Buddy
yeah, okay.
John.
Yeah.
Buddy
is,
John.
It, is it different for genders or no?
Carl or Anna? No, you can say no. June, Junie for any.
Oh, okay, nice.
John,
I love John June. I love the word June. I love it so much.
Carl,
John. I love this little twist in this conversation. I mean, we could just do this all day.
Yeah.
Should I wrap us out, Anna?
Yes, please. Yes, please.
Okay, this is Ethnically Ambiguous. If you don't know already, we're Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen, it's Shirohiro on Instagram, and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
Oof.
And I'm at Anna Hosian on Twitter.
Yeah. Thanks again, Carl. This was a fucking delight.
I had a great time. Thanks for having me, y'all.
Thanks. Okay, bye.
Bye. Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like $1 million.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.